Yeah, the first of the annual improvements that we're looking at today is in paper 2A and deals with key management personnel services. IS 24 identifies key management personnel as a related party of the reporting entity and require that compensation paid to the key management personnel should be analysed and disclosed. The questions about it was whether key management personnel could be an entity or just individuals. And the submitter particularly referred to the examples of mutual funds that typically don't have employees and obtain key management personnel services from separate servicing entities. The IASB addressed this by adding entities that provide key management personnel services to the definition of related parties. The amendment also required that amounts payable for key management personnel services are disclosed, and also recommended exempting reporting entities that use a management entity to provide those services from providing a detailed analysis of the compensation paid in the form used for employee emoluments. This is to report back the comment letters that we received on this topic. We received 64 comment letters on these proposals, and 43 agreed with the proposals with little comment, little or no comment. There were some concerns raised by respondents, which are recorded in the paper. Some respondents argued that management entities shouldn't be exempt from the detailed disclosures required for compensation paid to the key management personnel. They think it's valuable information for users. Some suggested that we could restrict the type of management entity for whom that exemption would apply, to exclude management entities that are solely set up as a vehicle for an individual key management personnel. Now, we don't think that would be feasible in practice for the reasons which we lay out in paragraphs 19 to 21. Others were concerned that the related party relationship isn't symmetrical in the proposals. The management entity is a related party of the reporting entity, but the reporting entity isn't a related party of the management entity unless it's a related party for some other reason. So we think that's right, because we don't think that the reporting entity, as a customer, exercises any influence over the professional management entity. Now, as a result of the comments received, the Interpretations Committee have accepted requests to extend the definition of a related party to include those entities that provide key management personnel services to the parent of the reporting entity as well, and also a request that the nature of key management personnel services should be disclosed. And there are one or two small drafting proposals which were included in paragraph 29. So Appendix B highlights the changes that have been made to the May 2012 proposals in the exposure draft, and Appendix A is a clean version of the proposals as they stand now. So the questions for you on page 10 are, do you agree with the Interpretations Committee recommendation to revise the proposed amendment to IS 24 by adding a requirement to disclose information about the nature and extent of the key management personnel services, and including the drafting suggestions recommended in paragraph 29. Have you any questions on those proposals?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Chairman. My question for you, April, is what if the management entity is controlled by the same individual or individuals as the reporting entity? So let's say the entity that's providing this service, the CEO of that entity is the same CEO of the reporting entity. What would be the outcome there?
Would that not be a related party?
Yeah, it would be a related party under other, for other reasons, for those reasons.
Okay, so it would be captured. It's just the words in paragraph 25 struck me and said, we do not think the reporting entity is a related party of the management entity solely because of the provision of KMP services. So you're saying that in addition, you'd have to have individual related parties.
And in the wording we actually use, unless it is a related party for other reasons.
Yeah. Where is that unless words?
And my brain stops.
Because that's kind of what I was looking for.
Yeah.
And I didn't see it.
Unfortunately, I haven't got this in color.
Would it be in the 9B?
Sorry, Pat, I can't actually find it just at the moment.
Assuming those words are added, then I guess I'd be okay, but that's what threw me.
In the middle of paragraph BC2 on page 18, we say the reporting entity cannot affect the management entity's activities, financial position, or profit, except through some other relationship.
Yeah, and it's kind of vague for me. That's the red lettering? I had a question mark, actually, on that BC2. That's exactly... I didn't think it was clear enough. So...
Okay, I'll make a note of that and see if we need to clarify the actual standard itself, the proposed amendment to the standard itself.
Brilliant, thanks.
April, quick question on the addition of in 9B10, or providing KMP services to the reporting entity or to the parent of the reporting entity. And I was just scratching my head a bit about why people thought it was necessary to add in to the parent of the reporting entity, because presumably the reporting entity would be disclosing services that were contributed or provided by its parent. And so if the service entity provided the services to the parent, wouldn't that get picked up in the disclosure of parents of transactions? I just didn't understand why people thought it was necessary to add the or to the parent of the reporting entity.
I think people thought it was necessary because they felt that obviously the reporting entity's parent mm-hmm. could push down those key management personnel decisions or effects. And so we thought it was important to make clear that key management personnel services could be provided to the reporting entity or could also be provided indirectly through its parent.
Right, but if they were provided through the parent, wouldn't the parent providing KMP services to the sub be required to be disclosed anyway?
If it were directly providing KMP services to the sub, it would be. We just wanted to make it clear that anyone providing those services to the parent also was a related party.
I didn't object. It just struck me as unnecessary.
Doc?
Yes, I was not persuaded well by the reasoning why we should add the information which is recommended in paragraph 30A. Your reasoning is starting from paragraph 26 to 28, but I couldn't really understand why we should add this information, because we are already requiring to provide the amount paid to this entity, and you are requiring additional qualitative information, and which is slightly deviating from original purpose of this this amendment. And of course, it would be nice to have such an information, but now we are tackling disclosure issue to reduce the volume of the disclosure, and this is against our effort. So I'm not quite well persuaded by why you added. And the paragraph 26 said only a few respondents suggested. Yeah, a few means more than two, less than many. So why you decided to add this?
I totally agree with Chuck. I'm not convinced that we need this disclosure.
We thought it would be useful if the nature of the services were more fully described, because then people would know whether they were providing services in one particular area or one particular part of the function of the entity, or whether they were providing, a broader range.
But this is not really original purpose of this disclosure. We asked them to disclose the amount, and disclosing the nature of the payment is not original intention of this disclosure. So I'm not quite well persuaded why we should do that now.
I mean, one of the suggestions that people who made this suggested was that we should disclose the number of employees working on providing these key management personnel services so that people would have a better idea.
Yeah.
But we didn't actually put that detail in because we thought it was too prescriptive.
Yeah, but it sounds like a deal. You know, we lose this information, but instead of losing this information, how about having such a nice another different kind of information? But this is not what we should do. So that's why I'm not so persuaded.
All I would say is just that the nature of these services is obviously at the core of an entity.
Right.
You know, it's directing the entity. It's deciding what the entity's actions are going to be.
Mm.
So it's the nature of the services was felt to be rather important, and hence the proposal to have this disclosure. I take the point that, you know, in general we're looking not to increase disclosure, but it was the importance of the nature of this that prompted this proposal.
But isn't the intention of the standard to disclose what's paid to related parties? And in this case, we've got an awkwardness because instead of people, we've got an organisation. I mean, we can always add disclosures and we can always ask for more of it, but I'm just not sure how useful this is going to be. And, you know, 43 of 64 were quite happy with what we proposed. We've got a few people. I just think it's overkill.
What if substantially all of the cost of sales or the equivalent of cost of sales, cost of services of an entity were provided by this entity? Would you think it's relevant or irrelevant?
Well, I don't know, but I don't think that's a related party question. That's a different question.
I think actually if you're suggesting that the key management that the management entity was to cause the reporting entity to purchase a large percentage of its purchases from a related party of the management entity, I think that would automatically get picked up by the other disclosures within IS 24 because we are one of the things we're doing here is deeming the management entity to be a related party.
I think perhaps what Pat's concerned about is whether or not the amount being charged by the entity is reasonable.
Exactly.
For the amount of services
nature
or the degree
extent
of
the amount.
Couldn't you ask that for any expense?
Well, if it's not a related party, then presumably it would be subject to the aggregation and materiality concepts that, you know, we have.
We don't typically in related parties, and we've never, to the best of my knowledge, ask whether the price charged between related parties was reasonable.
Because there's a presumption it's not arm's length.
There's a presumption it's not arm's length. You don't even know if the transaction would have occurred absent the relationship. So despite requests over the years, we've never ventured into saying whether or not something was appropriate.
But we're not asking for that here. We're asking for nature and extent.
Yep.
But actually, if you look at IS 24 for paragraph 18, what the disclosures are that are required for related party transactions during the period, it doesn't require a disclosure of the nature. You know, it says nature of the relationship, information about those transactions and outstanding balances, and then gives a list of minimum disclosures. And it's all focused on the balances and the expense, the amount. It doesn't ask for a description of the type of services. So if it were provided, it's correct that 18 wouldn't require it. So weirdly, we'd be requiring it for this one type when it was coming via an entity, but we wouldn't be requiring what's proposed there if it were from an individual.
But we have a rationale for that.
I don't think it's a very strong rationale. That really was Tuck's point.
Yeah. Well,
there's always a temptation in these things when we pick them up and fiddle. We've got 43 or 64 respondents saying, what you're proposing is fine. A couple say, why don't you ask another couple? And you can always add on new disclosures.
Can I get an indication who agrees with the Vice Chair?
With who?
With Ian. Ian. Chuck.
Ian?
Do you agree with your sentence?
I agree.
So we do not add in that disclosure. Otherwise, do we agree with the staff's recommendation?
Yeah.
Yes?
Okay. And question two, does the transitional provisions and effective date, the ED proposed that the amendment should apply for annual periods beginning on or after 1st of January 2014. Do you agree with that recommendation to reaffirm the transition provisions and effective date?
Yes, I agree.
Yes. Basis for conclusion, we think that it would be appropriate to include the basis for conclusion as a separate section so that we maintain the thinking of the previous basis for conclusion. And we also think that we should add something to the basis for conclusion to explain the reasons for the asymmetry between the management entity and the reporting entity as related parties. Do you agree with the Interpretations Committee to finalize the amendment to the basis for conclusion by including the a section that explains that asymmetry and presenting the proposed revisions as a separate section from the 2003 and 2009 basis? Yes?
Agreed?
Agreed.
Okay. Patrick?
Yes. So we move on to paper 2B. And the annual improvement regarding the classification of liabilities as current or non-current. IS1 states that a liability is classified as non-current if an entity expects and has the discretion to refinance or roll over an obligation for at least 12 months after the reporting period under an existing loan facility. The exposure draft proposes to amend IS1 to clarify that the loan should be refinanced or rolled over with the same lender on the same or similar terms in order to be classified as non-current. After considering the comments received from the respondents, the committee has decided to recommend to the ISB that it should not confirm the proposed amendment to IS1 in its current form. The committee thinks that the proposed amendments are not clear. It has observed that the basis for conclusions of the proposed amendment seems to tie the classification requirements in IS1 to the derecognition requirements of financial liabilities in IS39. In that case, the committee has noted that the assessment of whether the terms are the same or similar would include a quantitative analysis based on the so-called 10% test as described in IS39, and the committee thinks that it's not the right path to follow because this test is not appropriate for classification purposes and would raise practical issues. So the committee has decided to recommend to the ISB that this issue should rather be addressed through a narrow scope project to amend IS1. In that case, we think that the scope of the project should address issues that are linked to paragraphs 69D and 73 of IS1, including the meaning of the words unconditional right and discretion, and the meaning of the words settlement of the liability. So our questions to the board are the following. Does the board agree not to confirm the proposed amendment to IS1 in its current form? Does the board agree to address issues regarding the classification of liabilities as current or non-current as part of a narrow scope project? And does the board agree with the staff's proposals regarding the scope of the project?
Could I ask one question?
Yes.
In the paper, it's never really set out why you think this should be a narrow scope, and we're getting lots of narrow scope. So What basis did you make the decision not to put annual improvements or deal with it another way? It just says that's what you recommend. And I'm curious to know.
Well, I would say that the response that we got to the proposed original annual improvement plus the discussions in the Interpretations Committee led us to conclude that there wasn't a straightforward, easy answer to this. If there was, then I think we would be proceeding down the annual improvements line. There isn't. It is nevertheless an important issue where there is some diversity in practice, and so that's why the Interpretations Committee is proposing that we still continue on investigating this issue.
I think, too, that we've, over the years, had a considerable volume. Many of them didn't make it as far as the Interpretations Committee, but I know I've encountered them in many jurisdictions of people asking essentially the same questions over and over again about why do I have to classify this liability as current? And so it's clear they're not getting that from the language of IAS 1, and that's, I think, contributed to a lot of the decision.
But why couldn't that be fixed in an annual improvement?
I think it, by the time we got into it, I think the view of the committee was that it was beyond the scope of an annual improvement.
It'd be helpful if that was set out in the paper.
Point taken.
Philippe? Well, later this morning, we are going to discuss another proposed amendment, narrow scope amendment, ongoing concern, same IS1. Does the staff intend to group the two issues in the same proposed modification or to issue two separate things? They are very related. This matter of liquidity and whether the debt falls due and can be rolled over is a matter of going concern to a certain extent. And I personally hate the multiplication of small amendments following each other. So whenever we can group those things into one single amendment, especially when the two issues have some interconnection, like going concern and the liquidity of the debt, I think we should do that. Do the staff have any comments?
It wasn't something that we were planning to do. We saw the going concern proposals as being something quite separate and something that we wanted to progress within a reasonably quick period of time. This, I think, might take us a little bit longer, and I'd be concerned about delays to clarification related to going concern in order to clarify this classification issue.
Let me clarify. We have to think of our constituents who have to approve our standards and to put them into legislation, enforcement process. If we just issue series of small things, it's seen as very burdensome, as very annoying. So whenever we could try to regroup matters by nature into one single amendment of one standard, maybe two amendments of one standard, I think it's much better.
I agree.
So, I'm looking at paragraph 10 in your paper. So is there a problem with this revised paragraph 73, or is the problem with what's been written in the basis and the tying it to IS 39, IFRS 9 in the basis?
I think it's mainly related to what is written in the basis, but also many respondents answered that they would not be able to apply the amendments because they don't know what same or similar terms really mean.
Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, you use your judgment. That's what we're doing here, isn't it? I mean, it seems to me that amendment to 73 is perfectly sensible. Apply your judgment. It clarifies. Delete what we put in the basis. Delete that reference to IS 39 and drive on. I don't see the problem.
Well, same or similar terms is a significant area of, judgment. But it's also a problematic area because people don't know how to define what it means. It's not perfectly clear worldwide. And the attempt to tie it to IAS 39 was an attempt to at least put some structure around it.
Which word is difficult? Is it same? Well, that's easy. Similar.
Similar.
But we have significant. Our standards are littered with these words. I mean, if every time we use the word significant, we have to have an interpretation of what significant is. I mean, how far do we go in this, in responding to these things?
What is the alternative solution?
Well, I think just coming back to similar, I mean, we do have the guidance that is in I-Study 9 about renegotiation of loans and similar terms there. And so people were naturally looking at that. And we've said, you know, in coming back and looking at this a second time, no, that's not an appropriate basis to do this assessment of similar. So, yes, we've got this word similar, but we've got this other guidance that's in S39.
Well, does that mean that any time we use the word similar in any of our standards, it's cross-referenced to that bit of IS39?
But here it is, though.
No, and it shouldn't be. And what we're concluding here is that it shouldn't be, but there is a natural tendency to do so.
Well, why don't we say, don't refer to this bit in IS39 when interpreting the word similar? Use your judgment and get to a sensible answer. So to the question of, so what are we going to do instead? I mean, how are we going to spell it out in sufficiently clear language that people know what to do?
One alternative could be to develop a qualitative analysis that would be in IS1 and only for the classification of liabilities.
So you write the word similar in 100 words instead of one, but it still means similar.
Explain what similar means.
Steve, I will tell you that in my view, written just the way it is here, same or similar, in some jurisdictions, similar will mean a 50% change to the terms, and people will say, well, because it's with the same institution, it's still similar. But we saw that in the Greek debt restructuring, where people wanted to say, well, despite the fact that you turn one bond into 40 bonds plus a derivative, it's still, quote-unquote, similar.
Okay, so we say on the same terms or terms that are not significantly different. You use the word significant all the time, so they must understand that word.
I'm not sure how to respond, Steve. It's been a significant problem in practice. The Interpretations Committee came to the conclusion that the approach that was originally proposed of attempting to link it to IAS 39 raised more difficulties than solutions.
I can understand that, and we should delete that certainly.
But that doesn't change the fact that this is a significant area, especially among people who are moving to our standards and have been under regimes that are much more lax in the application of this.
Well, then, I think that's the issue. That's the issue.
Yeah.
I mean, when we discussed this initially, as you know, I stood on ceremony with respect to this whole issue, and I thought we were focusing on the wrong issue. We needed to focus on what the word unconditional meant. And I actually agree with Stephen completely. I would expect that if we do this further analysis, we will in fact come to the same outcome, and we will find that in most credit agreements, you do not have these unconditional rights. Why? Because no lender in his right mind, with good counsel, will ever eliminate material adverse change clauses if they're concerned about the creditworthiness, or material adverse event clauses. They're just basic to every credit agreement. And so the unconditionality doesn't exist. So same or similar, I think, is a bona fide threshold that we should have here. Otherwise, people are going to be doing exactly what Wayne suggested. They're going to be classifying obligations, okay, that are truly current as long-term, and that is going to give a misleading signal to the reader of the financial statement. So I completely agree with Steve. So do the work. We'll do the work. But I anticipate we'll come out with the same outcome.
You know, this is an area coming from practice some time ago. This is a significant area which requires guidance. And I think the board attempted to do that
granted that that it fell short with the comments and with the IFRIC. I respect it because I think I was persuaded by one comment here. I've not gone back and looked at it, but last week's reading, if you extend it by 1 year, as against 10 years, you get different answers because of the present value aspect of it. And I respect the pushback from the respondents and from the IFRIC to some extent, but I think kicking the can down the road and saying that we will do it as a separate narrow project, trust me, that's not going to happen anytime soon. And I think we ought to address the divergence in the practice. And we need to go back and think how we can repair it. And I think some of the suggestions that Steve said are a starting point. I'm not saying that they are, I agree them completely, but they are definitely a starting point. We need to think about it. And my write-up here is that, but should be done in interim, do not live with the divergence. And my other comment is that if we do it, will it become another exposure in the next annual improvement? But clearly, this doesn't meet the annual improvement if it is such a big area.
I've seen that.
Yeah.
So hence the proposal for a separate amendment.
I agree, and I'm contradicting myself to some extent, but I'm saying that if it is this, I can see your argument that it should be narrow because it's too broad. But I'm worried how to fit it in narrow annual improvement and do it in the next cycle because I somehow don't like making it a narrow project, and that ain't going to happen anytime soon. We're fully, our plate is full.
Unless you subcontract it to the interpretations committee. Allow them to develop it and bring it to you as a completed package.
I would say, this is something that the IFRIC should be able to take care of, isn't it?
Do an interpretation.
Yes.
Well, we could do it as potentially as an interpretation, as interpretive guidance.
This is not rocket science. It's
interpreting same or similar, isn't it?
Well, and unconditional and some of those other words I think have to be dealt with.
I thought your examples were great. I thought they illustrated the
problem.
Yeah. So.
So conclusion.
Push it back deeply.
Yeah. And then somehow, you know, we. I think that's the best solution. I see too often things bouncing back and forth between the board and IFRIC, and it takes so much time, and often the problems are not so huge, or perhaps huge, but can be solved quickly. And can we find ways to short-circuit this? Of course, with proper due process, but...
I think in this case, the practical aspects of the practical problems that are being faced in practice, the IFRIC is ideally suited to work on this. So I think putting it or asking the IFRIC to look at this again is an appropriate use of their skills in this case.
And I think we need to leave it to their judgment as to whether they bring it back to you as a proposed interpretation or back as a proposed completed with all the work done, narrow scope amendment. I think that's a judgment that, frankly, I haven't considered, and I think we ought to let them consider that.
Okay.
Thank you.
So decided?
Yes.
Yes.
Back
in. April again.
Back in.
Yep. Yes.